Hello, everybody. This is the Gingerbread Man, and I would like to welcome you to my home. Today's a special day. I haven't done this in a while. I have a friend with me, and this is the first of a first because this is a return journey. I've got my buddy Jay here. It's been almost like 2 years.
Yeah.
Maybe three. I have no idea.
Yeah.
I was going to look it up earlier.
2022.
Something like that. That's 3 years. You're not in a jumpsuit this time.
No, I'm not. No white glasses. Those got ruined. Just, you know, culturally speaking, you know.
Yeah. It was a turquoise jumpsuit.
Yeah. Green turquoise with a dead animal hat.
Yeah. That was wild. I have a skin.
You have a skin.
Had. But I think it's gone. Just like a goddamn
All right, well.
Pin.
Damn, that fell through.
Yeah. Every day. So how are you today?
I'm doing good, man. I'm in a better place now.
Yeah.
Than I used to be. I'm less in a wild place now. It's still fun, but, you know, careful and purposeful more so.
Okay. Now. Well, tell me what's different.
Substance use is in a different place these days. I'm not just filling up my day being high, and I don't even drink. It's been since October of 2024 since I've been alcohol free.
That's dope.
I'm there in that way. Doing more therapeutic stuff, you know. I've broken through a lot of barriers this year more than ever.
Well, tell me about one.
I'd say just because I deal with a lot of intrusive thinking. So having to break through like the days that I'm just held back with such an obsessive thought of any sort that I deal with in the day, just having to see through it, you know, had to work on that more and more.
Don't we?
Because it can take, and it's not even like knowing whether it's real or not. Sometimes it's just, it takes a lot of energy out regardless, you know, if it's something I actually need to worry about or not.
Well, every time the mind comes back to that chewy tidbit, you know, like I kind of see it like a cycle or a tornado, like it keeps being brought back to that obsession, you know, and I get that. I understand that. Working within substance use and timing, you know, the hardest part about anything is just arguing with our mind. And I kind of see it like a child almost, like it's like you have to train it, and it can be trying, and it takes patience, and it takes repetition. And then just like a child that wants a piece of sugar, it just keeps begging, you know, and of course that takes energy. Of course, it's exhausting. You know, like I can relate to that so heavily. I really do. Like,
it's I think it teaches a lot though too. I think, you know, I think some of the benefits of having to deal with things over and over is just the strength that comes from processing it,
mm-hmm.
and being able to let go of things in a more genuine way. Though I think people that don't deal with obsessive thoughts could do just fine, you know, just, you know, they could do just fine, you know, being in, what was I saying? I'm sorry.
You're talking about obsessional thinking, and like,
but they could like, what was I saying? Like they were.
So like an example of something that I end up doing, because I have neurosis around certain events and timings. And so, for instance, every time I leave the house, I have this fear that I'm going to leave a heat source on. And so I'll go and I'll do these circles around the apartment where I'll go and I'll check the torch, and then I'll go and check the vaporizer, and I'll go and check the stove. And it's crazy because I'll do all these things and I'll know that I did it, and I'll be on the way out the door. And it's like, I'll second guess myself.
Right.
And then I have to go back and I have to do it again. And I swear to God, every time I leave the fucking house, I do this 3 or 4 times. And it's like, I have to do it just so that I can make myself comfortable.
Yeah.
And I do the same thing at work too. Like it's always the heat sources. I'm terrified of leaving something on. And so like I'll walk through in a circle and then I'll have this like mental museum in my head that I can walk back through and be like, all right, I did do that, you know, but then I'll second guess it again.
Right. Do you ever like blank out when you're actually doing the task that you need to do? You just totally forget it. Yeah. It screws me up. I'm like, man, I just want to get Go. Through. Just want to.
And then I wonder why I'm 10 minutes late for work.
Every day. Right. It's yeah.
That 10 minutes walking through my house over and over again. I don't think it's a human trait. Of course, there's probably a spectrum and there's some, a lot of people who are a lot more composed. I think a lot of it perhaps has to do with fear in some aspect.
Yeah. I think, you know, anybody, I think that's what I was trying to say earlier. And that's what I forgot to say was I think anybody can face their fears and face things to get over things. We all have to do that. That's just common sense in that sense. But
I almost see it like this general, I don't think fear has to have a name. Of course, it's called fear. But I think it's kind of like almost like this ephemeral just state that's just there. And I think fear is the root of anger. I think anger is a attempt to let fear out because it's like there's like a pressure thing. Like fear creates pressure and then it has to come out in some way. That could be thinking about what we think is our fear and projecting ourselves into the future. But it could also be all these other ways of like, you know, reckless driving and taking advantage of people in order to institute power. But I think at the base of all these things is just this general feeling of dis-ease. Disease, but dis-ease.
Yeah, like you're not at ease with something. You're kind of, there's something uncomfortable.
Uh-huh. And I think people who are really composed are able to exert themselves powerfully over the world in some way. I think they still have fear, you know. But I think the less power you have, then it becomes harder to deal with it. You know, that's where a lot of my insecurities come from. I think that's why I obsess about leaving the house and turning fires on.
I don't know. You have to be comfortable. You have to do things comfortably to be able to move through. But I think, you know, one technique that I know of is that you can have something comfortable with you while you're going through difficult, uncomfortable things.
Like a safety blanket?
Yeah, and then it's kind of like, like a halfway point in that sense that makes it feel more secure.
So what would an example of that be?
Like one very simple one is like if you have to make a difficult call to someone, go to your favorite room or go to your bed or go to your closet or go to the deck or whatever, wherever you feel the most comfortable and just make the difficult call there.
I like to be at home.
Yeah.
Like, I like to do important stuff on my computer, not on my phone.
Like, if you have to go somewhere for a meeting, you know? You know, just wherever, computer, like you said. You just have something comfortable with you. I know for me, when I'm working on my stuff, I have to have something playing. I have to have some YouTube video happening, some show that I like.
More music or words?
I play a lot of comedy in the background.
Okay.
Or sometimes I'll have a video game in the background, just go back and forth. But I haven't done that in a little bit.
Have you ever heard of Danny LaBelle?
Tell me.
He's a comedian.
Yeah, no, I haven't.
I'm going to have to send you some of his stuff. I'm obsessed with
Sick.
Him. I love him.
Nice.
He's awesome. Wow.
Cool.
So I'm going to use, I guess, for my example would be DMT. I ritualized DMT. When I was younger, I would do it a lot, and especially when I'd get home. Like, when I'd get home from work, I would smoke DMT. But it'd be very often for me to smoke multiple times throughout the day, and then I was shocked when I was having horrible experiences, and I started scaring the fuck out of myself. And so over the last couple years, I've ritualized the ordeal to the point that, of course, the initial rule is spontaneity. and I try to have zero forethought before I do it. And when I do end up doing it, it's got to be a split second decision, and I got to hop on it. Like, so if I'm on my way home from work and I decide that I want to smoke DMT when I get home, that's too much time to think about it. And so then I have to put it down and wait another day. And then what I used to do is I would do what I call the rabbit hole, where I'd always have a big bowl and I'd take a small hit. And before I come all the way down, I'd take a little bit more. And before I come all the way down again, I'd take a little bit more. And I do that over and over and over again until eventually the last one would fuck me. You know, and a lot of my really, really fearful experiences come from that. So I don't do that anymore. You know, like whenever I do it, my spontaneous moment comes and bubbles up. And then I go and I do one hit. That's it. And then what seems to happen almost two out of three times, especially now that I'm older, is that like I can't hoodwink myself. And so sometimes nothing will happen. And now I don't go and I don't do the repeat. I don't do the chase. And so I just walk away. I gotta wait a couple days. You know, until the spontaneous moment arises again. But for me, I've noticed the two things that I need that make me feel comfortable is my gray blanket. For some reason, that blanket, like I literally like to just hold it. And it doesn't even have to be next to me. I don't even have to have it on me. But as soon as I touch that blanket, for some reason, it has become this totem. And then my cat, you know, like without fail, I swear to God, like she smells it or something. But whenever I smoke, I'll sit down and pitter-patter, she's already there. And she sits on my lap, and like a lot of the time she's like, she'll like bear down, put her paws out, and it's almost like she's trying to hold me down so I don't float away. And like, I swear to God, though, if I have those two things, knock on wood, it's been a really long time since I've had that fearful, because for me, DMT is this super short but exaggerated example of a lot of things, you know, and it's a lot of different faces and a lot of different stories that she tells. But without fail, within that first second can be some of the most strongest fear that I've ever felt in my life. And I call it the oops a minute, where I'm like, I get, sometimes I'm like, oh, fuck. You know, and it's like, you can't run away, but it, like, it, at least it's only 5 minutes.
Right. But you're right. It's super, I just remember it being so intricate when I last did it.
Mm-hmm.
Just, I always describe it as like the best art piece that I'll never be able like ever imitate in any other way. Maybe like clues of it, but it's so, I mean, what she brings is truly
a thousand different pictures.
Yeah. Just, I mean, I felt so many things. I thought so many things within the design of it all. Just of what you go over in your mind, because that's what, you know, you just, it's a confrontational sort of deal.
With you and you.
Yeah.
But having those two safety things, I think, is amazing. Amazing.
For sure. Yeah. I think anybody should do it. And I think what's most important out of all of it is that there is a baseline, for sure. And I think, you know, we're always wondering what reality is constantly. And I think that's something to acknowledge. But I think also to know where people at and feeling, you know, as much as it's an abstract to know what people are feeling.
Are our feelings real?
Well, and I think our expression is real of what we can interpret of those feelings as best we can, right? Like, we know so much language to describe ourselves.
So there's sometimes the feeling.
There's the feeling.
And then there's the interpretation of the feeling?
Yeah, there's a feeling. There's observation of someone feeling that and then, relating it back to us, mirroring it back, you know. So I think it's really interesting how sometimes the description of a person from one world and description of their feelings from another world, and they try to come together and relate those feelings. I wonder how much they would actually relate, because it just depends on the interpretation and what they're assigning.
So you have two strangers as an example.
Yeah.
But they encounter the exact same event.
Yeah, say it is the feeling. Say it is the same feeling.
Would they feel the same?
Would they even relate it? Would they even agree? Would they would they, you know, how would it go? And I think, you know, to some extent, I think there would be some, there's always those primal moments when communicating with someone that you can just read off of someone how someone is feeling if you felt that way and saw that. What the label to that feeling is could be mind-blowing how relatable that person is. And, oh, that's what they mean. What, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
It's because we go off of so much.
You could have the same person.
Semantics in the world.
You could have the same person have the same event happen on two separate days. You know, so if we have a math equation here, two of the variables are identical, but the effect of how they felt from day to day could be very different. So at that point, I start to get confused as where does the feeling come from if it has nothing to do with what's happening, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Like, it really astonishes me, you know, because I have all these ideas on things that I think that I don't want to do. Like, and this is something I've been struggling with a lot lately. I've never wanted to go to work. I've always super struggled ever since I was younger when I first got my first job. Probably never would have got my first job if it wasn't for my son.
Yeah.
I would have just tried to sell drugs or something. But like that feeling of not wanting to be there is really hard on me, you know? And I remember the same way in school, being really fucking bored, you know? Like, I guess what I'm trying to say, the thing doesn't matter, you know, because I found that I've gotten really good at working now. And I can go in and there's this way of crafting our feelings, you know? I don't know if I'm being confusing here.
Oh, keep going.
Like, and it's amazing how much you can enjoy something that you thought you hated. And that's the ultimate alchemy that I've been trying to figure out, is how I can be more in control of these things, you know? And like, with this topic today being reality,
right?
Like, I'm not sure how real these feelings are. You know what I mean? Like, what do you think?
I think, because this is literally my life. this is what all my counseling has been about, you know, just trying to deal. What I've always known it to be from reading a favorite book of mine, that feelings and thoughts are just feelings and thoughts, and they come and go. It's reaction to everyday life, whatever we're thinking. Sometimes what we're thinking makes us feel a certain way. We get caught up in a certain sense. I think, you know, if we were to go into like a super neutral aspect of it, yeah, I mean, that's what makes us think of needing to do dishes maybe once in 2 weeks or 3 weeks, whatever, how long those things have been out. But in another sense, I think it does take us away from that present moment that we all actually really want, I tend to find.
Is there a lot of feeling in the present moment?
Depends what present moment you're having.
Exactly. You know,
I think there's some moments you really don't want to be in that present moment. You just want to dissociate. And
I feel like when I'm completely involved in something, I'm not doing a lot of thinking.
Yeah. Well, yeah, if you're like in the moment, like you have to handle something like you just do your best in that situation, you're not thinking about anything because you just want to, you have to get it, whatever's done, whether you're saving something or.
So, you know. X event happens.
Right.
The thing in the world, which we can kind of consider as the source of reality, is this thing out there, whatever the fuck that means.
Right.
Right. So now, my vessel, mind, body, whatever, comes into contact with this event and it spawns a feeling. in order for me to judge it, I then have to think about it, you know?
Yeah.
And I think where the peace happens when I'm at work and I'm somehow enjoying it, even though this is this thing that I've spent so much time thinking I don't want to be there. But if I can manhandle the expectations away from it, I don't have the chance to insert those little thoughts, because it's like this daisy chain of just nonstop. Like, it's kind of crazy how things just continuously keep going. And it's maddening. And it's like a slippery, slippery slope. And if you think about it too much, it's fucking almost scary.
That middle road that you try to walk to not get off that road of trying to just be effective with anything. And you, because I've noticed just anything, like, these little things can cause us to, like, yell at, say, our partner, right? And, or, like, have these arguments and just these little lights and whatever. And I think it just shows, like, how much we can really just get caught up with thought just by fear. And we're going to have fear no matter, you know, how enlightened someone can be.
I agree.
It's always just... And I think the whole point is it's being aware of when that happens, right? I think a lot of times I've wanted to be such at a baseline with things that I would never worry about things. But the reality is if I'm going to worry about things, tend to that worry if it's that intense, I think. But there's a lot of people who don't get as much of that opportunity as I get to worry about that stuff.
Because people have more struggle or more busyness or
busyness.
They just don't have enough time to sit around.
Literally working. You know, people working 8 or more hour jobs, double work, you know, all of that. You don't get that much time to think about things sometimes. Or you're thinking about it while you work, but the processing of it is not exactly therapeutic, you know. I think people should have that time at home for as much time as they need to be able to do that, but not everybody has that opportunity. And I haven't had that opportunity all the time in life either, so I know what that's like to just, you know,
take advantage,
to be on such a go that you don't give yourself time to really want to heal, or you worry about so much about that you're not in the position you want to be, that you're afraid to heal because you think that you're just such this shitty person. You know, it could be so twisted like that. And that's where I think getting caught up with thoughts and feelings goes. It just gets so abstract that it's everything becomes surreal in comparing thoughts. Mm-hmm. Because you can mix anything with anything. You could rationalize anything with anything.
Make anything make sense.
Yeah. Like, it'd be so uncomfortable to be in a room with someone who's, like, found a whole rationale through all the shit that they've been through to somehow be okay with pedophilia. Right? Mm.
Or, like, a murderer.
Yeah. Like, you... That it could get that surreal, and it's so uncomfortable to see that transition in action. There's like performance art and films that explore that sort of deal, and it's uncomfortable, but it's uncomfortable for a reason.
There's a reason people watch it,
because I think that's the reality of how thought can really... I keep touching the mic. That's how I think it gets too rational, and even, you know, for me, suicide became a really big rationale for me. Because I wanted it for so long, but couldn't own up to it. So, but there's a complex to that where you're not... It's not just that you want to leave, and it's not that you just want to stay here. It's a whole battle with what do I do with my existence altogether.
I think it's a battle that a lot of people probably consider.
Right.
And I think it's a human nature part of it. I don't think there's anything to judge there.
I think it's like sensors on electronics. It's not so much that no one deals with No one doesn't deal with struggle. Everybody deals with struggle somehow, some way, in any class, any form. It's not always talked about by everyone. And it's always going to be like that. Some people will talk like that, and that's fine. People can be more open in that. But there are going to be people who hold it back, and it's for good reason. And I think the real big part of it is how you're taking all of that struggle in. How is it affecting your thought process? Is it affecting you in a way that you're more in conscious control of it? Or is it subconsciously doing it so much and consciously doing it that you just start reacting to the world in a whole different way, sometimes in unhealthy ways?
Mm-hmm.
It's the reaction to whatever is coming at you. Everybody has everything come at them. But I've seen stories where people are so smooth with it most of their lives, or it seems like it. Now, people can always hide things or whatever, but for the most part, there's people who can smoothly handle it, and their life has been pretty good socially or family-wise, whatever aspect.
Well,
and, but I also think people can...
I think comedians would be a great example of what you're speaking about, because I think like Robin Williams or Ralphie May, these are people whose job is to entertain and to make people happy. But you see this common thread where a lot of these people have a lot of internal struggles.
Oh, yeah.
And there seems to be this duplicitousness where the artist who has something to express is using their pain as the coal, as the source for it.
The punchline. Mm-hmm. Yeah. They're trying to find that humor that and sometimes it's gallows humor in that sense. And
you hear a lot of these people say that they think that if they were happy, sensitive. They wouldn't be funny anymore.
Yeah.
And that's concerning.
One of the things that gets listed as like what is usually needed from comedians, I don't know, I forget who said it, but it was like one of the things is being erratic. That life has unpredictable turns, and that's part of the humor of a joke anyway. You get into, there's sometimes big perceptive awareness, sometimes it's very based awareness, sometimes it's something nobody, and it goes on and on to what nobody expects, because that's what we're going to laugh at. At just what we don't expect, whether it's because of the expression that they committed with, whatever, but it all comes from them just receiving life in these details that some of them were harder to process than the audience would ever know. Sometimes it's super common, but for the most part, it's like knowing your makeup. Even that is like a whole debate on whether it's real or not. Just knowing your what makes you up, what makes up your values and beliefs, what makes up you, realizing what it means to feel good and do good, if doing good is a thing that makes you feel good, you know?
Like altruism.
Yeah. I think there's a neutral barrier there. I think some people are fine getting a high off of life, doing all sorts of drugs. And then they can get off them and live a good life. Maybe it works out like that for them. But kind of like what I was alluding to before, it just depends on how much someone is talking about it too. Because there's so much that can happen in people's lives that some people will never know and some people will. Sometimes not even for personal reasons. It's just whatever you're telling or showing somebody at one point. You know, there's things that in my life that showed to different people that had reasons to not like me. And then there's parts of me that show to others in life. Maybe both sides of that sometimes, but they find a reason to like me.
Hmm.
You know, there's all sorts of that for everyone. And even knowing someone's story, it also depends on how much a person believes that story.
Like, or even if the entire message was transmitted in the first place.
Yeah. Do they even understand what that means when they say they got angry?
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like, there's always all sorts. Some people could have a lesser version, like, oh, you were little. And some people could have something as big as the worst domestic violence you would ever know.
Mm.
You know? can be painted in different ways, abstracts. So, I think that's what commits to whether it's real or not.
In what way?
I think because you're wondering the picture of what someone's telling you unless you can verify it yourself. Mm. Verification.
So now it's like this funny thing where I guess what I'm kind of trying to fight is I don't think reality's out there. Like that's kind of like part of the confusion is this separation almost. Like, because as soon as we start considering what's out there, we're not there. You know? Like, in Buddhism, there's this kind of this holism almost, this idea that everything, the world, reality, is a totality. And what we do with our thoughts is that we come in and we start cutting everything up into pieces. And we start describing things. We start naming things. And we start saying, this is separate from that. This is different from that. And I think a big part of our condition and fear is that almost subconsciously, we've been born inside this bubble inside of ourselves. And so almost everything that's experienced is experienced through our descriptions and through our judgments.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah.
And so now I start to doubt what I'm labeling as real if I know wholeheartedly that I'm part of real.
Right. You're experiencing it. It's valid, right?
Yeah.
I think that's something we're coming to realize, but it's still a weird gray area too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in the criminal side of things and dramatic side of things with people's lives. But yeah, I think it's just whatever's effective, right? Like, you're just saying whatever is effective at the end of it all, right? Might not describe every single detail of what's happening, but if you're going to tell someone an emergency's happening and what that is, you're going to go for the most efficient way of describing that, right?
I agree.
So it depends on what you mean and how people take things seriously or not.
I do wholeheartedly agree.
Dope.
Looking for...
I'm glad. Glad to be agreed with. Love it.
I'll give you 2 seconds. So right in here, I'm holding Chuang Tzu. This is a book of his parables.
Nice.
I was considering trying to paraphrase it, but I want to read this one out. And this kind of has to do with what I think we're talking about. This is called Two Kings and No Form. The South Sea King was called Act on Your Hunch. The North Sea King was called Act in a Flash. The king of the place between them was called No Form. Now South Sea King and North Sea King used to go together often to the land of No Form. He treated them well. So they consulted together. They thought up a good turn, a pleasant surprise for No Form, and a token of their appreciation. Men, they said, have 7 openings for seeing, hearing, eating, breathing, and so on. But No Form, he has no openings. Let's make him a few holes. So after that, they put holes in No Form, 1 a day for 7 days. And when they finished the 7th opening, their friend lay dead. Lao Tan said, to organize is to destroy.
Mm.
So, in this parable, I think this describes how I see reality as everything before I thought about it.
Right.
And then we come in and we cut, we segment everything up.
I'm trying to tell you to keep it. Just because.
So, reality, God, to even put it even a more abstract way, I see it all as existing before we described it. you know, and it's untouchable. It's like holding water. I mean, you can kind of hold water. So like something that's slippier than water, like something that you can't hold, like the idiom about trying to hold a soap bar or something, you know, and like, and it makes it, it's, this is part of the reason why I found it so hard to sit and record for a while is like, I started to lose faith in my words. I go through these like these eddies, these ebbs and flows where I will have confidence in my ability to communicate. And then there will come times where, and it's not really just like whether communicating is worth it or not. It's just I lose faith in my ability to transmit what I want.
Right.
You know, and it's like if I say something and I can't trust that my message is going to get across, it comes to the point where I don't want to talk.
Right.
You know, and it's like...
Yeah. Especially if the reception sucks. Like,
it could be just me in an empty room at that point.
Can be. You could do everything right and still think like, what the fuck did I do wrong, man?
Like, so like...
You know?
I find...
I know that's what I think.
Oh yeah, 100%. But it's like, it's an oxymoronic quest, our lives. You know, it's like the silly thing that I think we're all doing. Not in like a pessimistic way. So I'm reading Carlos Castaneda's A Separate Reality, which is the book that comes after the teachings of Don Juan. Do you know who Carlos Castaneda is?
Nope.
So Carlos Castaneda was this journalist guy. He went down, I think he was either Arizona or New Mexico, like somewhere in those border states. And he was looking for somebody to teach him about ethnobotanical plants. He was interested primarily in peyote. So this is the 1960s, and we're right at the cusp of the hippie revolution. And he wants to go find a medicine man to teach him about these things. And so he ends up running into this guy named Don Juan, who is a Yaqui Indian shaman, and he gives him mushrooms and datura and peyote and basically sends him on all these vision quests to train him how to be a sorcerer. And so it has had a lot of flack because he wrote it as if it was a biography. And as it's turned out, most likely it's a fiction. Well, my opinion on it is that most likely he did spend time with Yaqui Indians. Whether or not Don Juan actually existed, I think he's writing about real stuff. It's just he fictionalized it. But one of the things he was speaking about is the difference between looking and seeing. And he says that, or at least Don Juan says in this book, that everybody can look at the world, but to actually see the world as it is to see everything as unimportant. Because when you can see everything, the differences start to fall away. Because the differences come from our judgmental mind. It comes from looking at it and painting our ideas on the world. You know?
Right, how we process our sensory.
Mm-hmm. But there's also an ability to look at something. I think the best example, I think that's why they're using these hallucinogenic plants, is that hallucinogens sort of knock away some of that describer.
Right.
If that makes any sense. Like, however, I don't know. What do you think?
I think we make meaning out of what we see. And I think when it comes to hallucinogens of some sort, I think there's a difference between just making meaning out of things and getting more meaning out of things too. But I think it all comes from just how we're hit and the patterns that we see in our lives and what we've learned about certain patterns over time. Some things can always be wrong. Some things can be wrong at some point. Some things stay right.
Are patterns real?
I think it's the closest to real we have. I think pattern making, it can come from a biased side. So that's where I sort of hesitate to say it's totally real, because it's pattern making. You know, it's another way of interpreting. With that said, there is such a thing as that that collective conscious effort, which is, can be as simple as just people conversating and sharing things and connecting on things more and more, you know, I think in that sense, there can be such a thing as objective reality. The way that we see it, though, we always have to end it with some type of subjectivity, because it's the way that we're seeing it. It's what we see happening, and some things
can
react the way that we're thinking that it's happening.
Is it possible for humans to be objective? Like, in the clinical sense of that word, is it even possible?
I think there will always be a search for objectivity, because we always want to know what's happening and what to do next.
Because it's the real. It's that,
right.
It's that thing that's
what's real to us in that moment, what we're experiencing in front of us, what we know about things in the past and what we can know about now. And it can always distort what's actually out there, because you can miss opportunities that you wouldn't have taken because of a certain way that you look at the world.
True. However, if we can never actually touch the out there, you know?
Right.
That's where I start to get confused.
I think that's why I just say I think there will always be a search for objectivity.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what that is. I mean, it has to come from a subjective place. It's such a loaded question.
Mm-hmm.
Like, what's objective? Well, you go with what data is out there, and you go with how the systems work in certain places. You know, there's always such a term called industry standards, but what is an industry standard? It's what they found to be the most efficient for what they're doing. Maybe there's something else that does something better for their work or environment. But sometimes you never know, because that's the thing. The industry standard is just what most of the industry could use for whatever field it is.
It's like a legal precedent.
Yeah.
You know? Like, if nobody's ever been prosecuted, it could be something incredibly horrible, you know? But if nobody's gotten in trouble for it yet, there's no precedent set yet.
Right.
Like, it's the exact same with all these.
Think of, like, manipulation. Think of how it's like not a crime, yet it can really mess with people's heads to a very dangerous point.
Mm-hmm.
If it's the type of manipulation that's not in anyone's best interest and only to traumatize them at some point and cause trust issues, right? So even though that's not a huge crime, and some people would even find some benefits of that depending on the incidences, yeah, for the most part, it's still...
Well, give me an example. Like, what kind of manipulation in this instance?
I think... Well, manipulation just comes from the intention, right? You have to intend on manipulation for it to be manipulation sometimes. I think there can be unintended sometimes. Like, when you do this, this makes me feel this way, then we always have to do this.
Well, parenting is... manipulation.
In some way, yeah. I think in that sense, you know, there's boundaries that you set. And I think, but that's like the baseline of, that's like the basic level of manipulation, is just how we interact with life.
To obtain something you want through another person, because
right.
We're social creatures.
You gotta get the person's attention. That's manipulation, right? And then you ask them a question so that you hold them to listen to you.
So...
But that's like the basic line.
Yeah, manipulation. I would say a subbreed of this would be misinformation.
Yeah.
Which,
I'm talking about that.
You can have a data packet, you know, an event that happens in the world, and you have alternate camps that are trying to describe said event.
Right.
Now, if there is a discrepancy between the world views, the view that doesn't correlate with reality, the misinformed person,
mm-hmm.
say they don't even know that it's faulty information. They take it as fact, and they perpetuate it. if in their heart they believe it is what they do, an evil act.
It's a very good question. I think if
who's responsible at that point to make sure that people are getting the right information?
Depends on who's taking control. And it depends on it depends on who thinks they have the best argument, the rhetoric, right? It's the rhetoric that comes with it, but it's also the data that comes with that rhetoric that's going to swerve people, especially nowadays. Mm-hmm. This point, manipulation from media is always has been such a tired talking point for so long. That's how much it's been talked about, right? So people are even if they're not totally privy to what's going on, there's at least a heightened sense of concern for not getting that misinformation. But it's gone both ways. There are people who are even more misinformed than before, trying to not be misinformed. Mm. That can be a deep rabbit hole within itself. And I think anybody can fall into that with any ethical background. I think some could avoid it more than others, and can be much more closer to living in an objective reality than some. But everybody's privy to think of ideas that don't agree with most. And that's the whole, even Neil deGrasse Tyson said, that's the whole point with science. You put it in the ringer, you see how that idea works. And if it's working so far, then that idea is valid in a scientific term. Now, it's still in a human conceptualized system. You're never going to escape human conception. Nobody ever will. Nobody ever will. We know that now. But there is some testing that can prove theories that we try to transmit out in the world. Mm-hmm. And that's what discussion and experimentation is all about, and seeing what works and what doesn't. Sometimes it takes screwing up the idea in the same sense multiple times to realize that it doesn't work. And sometimes it takes that because someone is very arrogant and scared to not use the idea.
Have you seen the Ocean Gate documentary about the Titan submersible?
No.
Oh, that's the guy who, the multi-million-dollar dude who built a submersible, and he was trying to take it down to the Titanic.
Oh, yeah, okay, I remember that.
The documentary's really good, because it's just this long list of him just ignoring people telling him that it was a bad idea, and he just kept pushing because he believed in it, and his worldview killed 5 people. So earlier we were talking about making sense and how we as humans are really good at rationalizing our decisions and making our actions more agreeable. In the context of misinformation, when we have this litany of sources, I think it's very easy for somebody to go out and just cherry pick enough information to confirm their identity. How they're picturing themselves.
Especially if they got a community to do it. Channel 5 News, Andrew Callaghan, pretty much concluded that from a lot of things that he was covering.
Who's that?
It's comedy-based, but he went to Trump rallies and like Antifa rallies, like a bunch of other, like Flat Earth conventions, and it's these awkward-esque interviews. And a lot of what he gathered from even some of the more repeated characters that would just show up to these rallies and he would cover, that a lot of the time they were disconnected from their families more and more, and they were just trying to find community. And so sometimes our worldview is determined by the community that we need or want.
Mm-hmm. And the honest, real community that we're in.
Yeah.
I was listening to a podcast yesterday. It was a science podcast, and it was talking about play. And like a lot of the big arguments that I have with my son over the last couple of years have been concerned heavily with TV and screen time and all these things. And the science lady, one of the things that she said was that children find the things that they need to play with. Every single generation, back hundreds of years, each generation of children, they play with the things that they need in order to be a part of their society. And so, in a way, the fact that Odin spends almost 90% of his time playing online games, but he is socializing with these people, and the world that we're moving into, in a way, he's preparing for it.
Right.
You know, and I can see the rationale behind it. You know, he's getting the skills he needs to do to be able to communicate with people on this online space. And right. Most likely that's the world that we're heading into, you know, and like, I'm sitting there being the old geezer just fighting because I'm irritated they don't, he won't do what I'm telling him to do.
Right.
But like, it's a moving target too, which makes it even more trying to find this real world that's out there. You know, it's a moving target.
Yes, I think everything is like the discovery of something that was new to us when we were alive as young kids, right? You discover, oh, there's this TV. Now I can talk to my friends online without using a home phone. You know, that's so cool. That's awesome. And then there's the side that's it's overkill. Like, where's my oxygen? Where can I get more oxygen from? Where can I get different oxygen from? Sometimes you just want to go hiking in the forest because you're just inside so much with this magical, you know, can game all the time whenever.
Stimulation.
Yeah, it's not just circuit boards playing pre-made whatever reaction. It's just so digital, it's insane.
I'm like, I can relate because when I was younger, that was very similar to what I spent my time doing. I liked reading a lot, but I also had a Game Boy. And I distinctly remember having Pokemon Emerald. And while I was playing it, I remember I had one save on there that had 175 hours. And that was only one save. There was multiple saves. And like, when I was his age, he's basically what I was doing. I was constantly fighting this fear of boredom and always trying to stimulate myself some way, somehow. Right. And then when I got older, it was drugs. But what happened with me is that I got bored. Like, the older I got, it started to become harder and harder to find something that would capture my attention.
Yeah.
To the point that I would have this visceral fear that I wouldn't be able to find something that I'd be interested in again. You know, and I remember when I realized that I wasn't going to be able to find happiness in video games anymore. You know, and that this wasn't something that I could lean on. You know, and then I started to have those same feelings about drugs. You know, there's nothing that you can really stand on as this perpetual source of entertainment or whatever, you know? Like, there's nothing to fill in that space. Like, and I tried to get that communicated to him the other day. Me and him were sitting in the car, probably, or on a bike ride. I don't remember exactly where. But I was trying to tell him, I was like, you know, it's fine for you to do with this. I think it's important for you to have your time. That's why when you are on the TV, I feel it's important for you to have this unstructured time for you to recreate or do this recreation. However, I just need you to realize that this may not be something that you can lean on for the rest of your life, that you can't lean on anything. You have to be able to make your own attention, you know? And that, like, that's why I read hard books. That's why I do things that are difficult. Like,
yeah. And you're telling him now because it's something that you had to discover for yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we feel that way as people when we're trying to pass down our experiences to the youth. We're like, what did I want?
I wish somebody would have told me.
Yeah.
Nobody ever told me.
Yeah.
Nobody ever told me that, you know.
Right.
Yeah.
There's things I wish I had more experience in, so I didn't have to lean on it so much in my 20s. You know? I wish in some ways... And I don't think it would have actually equaled in that way. But sometimes I would think that if I partied more, then I would have gotten sick of it. And I could have been more responsible in my 20s, like some people that I see.
Mm-hmm. And some people just don't get sick of it.
Some people keep it more casual and they keep, or they loop it with their work or something.
Or they just make it their life.
Yeah. Like, they work it in, right?
Yeah, or they never drop.
But I think there can be aversions sometimes. You know, you have your time with it. Like, now I have my aversion with alcohol. But in my 20s, I was down. I wasn't an alcoholic, luckily. But I was down for it whenever it was around or available, if I could afford it and I didn't smoke weed. Weed was more of my habit and still is. But, I think... aversions can happen at a certain point with people. Mm-hmm. And I think that's important to think of in life too, because we're going to decide to do things that even the smallest of business decisions, like we're going to do things that we regret no matter what.
Well, because life is inherently riskful.
Right. And I tend to believe now that I think that's what heaven and hell is in a certain way. I think it's just an interpretation. I'm not trying to say whether it's legitimately heaven or hell.
Like as a mental state?
I think like there's certain things you shouldn't do because you're gonna, shit could happen so much or backfire, or your regret will go so deep downhill, or it will seep into your life, and you know, so much could happen existentially if you do this certain thing. And I think, you know, we've had to interpret that for thousands of years, what our morale is. That's the whole point of society, right? That's the reason we're either selfish or not selfish, because we think of certain ideas that are real, and then we discover that there's counter thoughts to that, and, you know, the whole discussion and argument thing. Mm-hmm. And then we see how we should actually act. And I think... overall, we're going to be bumping. I always think of it like a bowling ball where you're bumping on the sides with the safeties. Hmm. Right? And you just start going.
What do they call those things?
I think it's safeties. I think it's bumper.
Oh, yeah.
Bumpers. Yeah.
Bumpers.
Yeah. And it's. You just find your way towards landing on things. And. Yeah. And you get shaped up, and sometimes if you. You know, yeah, if you are going to be too content with things that don't make things actually good for you, it can have that consequence. But you find your heaven if you can. And you just live in it and you love your choices. You don't make any choice. But sometimes you have to make choices for your income that don't always follow up. And that's... something that's hard to avoid when that reality hits you in the face. So, but I also think people can be empowered to make choices and ultimately, is life worth living or not, and make that choice to either whether it is or not. Mm-hmm. But I think it takes also submitting to where you bumped into and are going now, and just coping with whatever you can, even if you're the biggest fuck up, like not even the likable kind, like a murderer or, you know, essayist or whatever, right?
An essayist?
Sexual assault is. Oh. I don't know. You're on platforms. I already said rape earlier, so I guess it doesn't fucking matter. But
the rape is the thesaurus.
I'm too late. I'm trying to be safe about it. So, I think if you're even so deplorable, right? Just the most deplorable that you can think of, right? Imagine. They have to cope with it somehow, too, if they're not going to off themselves or get offed somehow.
Or they don't even know.
Or they don't even know. Sometimes their awareness kicks in when no one will see it. Or maybe it never does. Maybe it's just the arrogance is reigning forever. And they'll just... It can be that sad.
I'm really glad that's not my life.
And that's, I think, something to be grateful for.
Like sometimes, like... As far as thoughts go, you know, like... I think way too much.
I think
more than I should. 90% of my struggles and my hardships are self-induced.
Yeah.
You know, and like, even though I don't think out there exists, I'm really trying to move there. I want to live in that place.
Right.
Somehow one day.
That's where most of our talks behind the scenes are.
I want to be out there so bad, even though I don't know how to get to where you can't go.
Right.
But I'm convinced that it's all based on how I think about it, you know? And then at the same time, I've tried to be a perfectionist, and in my talks with my therapist, she always tries to push me into, so she's an IFS therapist. So you know what IFS is?
I forgot.
So it means internal family systems.
Okay.
And so basically it's the idea of family therapy when you have like a family, you know, mom, dad, bunch of kids, whatever. When you approach that group, you approach it as a system. And so say the kid's having a hard time, you got like a 10-year-old boy in the family or something, and they're having a hard time. How do you deal with that? And so the idea of IFS is like your own brain and your own mind is like a family system, and we have different aspects of our personality, you know, and that there's different types of these pieces inside of us. Like he calls them like managers. There's like managers who come in whenever there's a hardship, the manager comes in and tries to manage it, you know, and then there's like firemen, firewomen, whatever, who come in and try to put out fires, you know. So the manager comes in, calls the firemen, you know, oh, he's freaking out, you gotta do this, you know, whatever. And then you have exiles, which are the parts of our pieces, like that little boy that we don't like. And so we put the little boy in the room and we say, I don't want to talk to you, disgust me, I don't want to think about you, you know. And the family, what does that little boy do when he's treated that way? Most likely he's going to come back and be angry, kick the door down, run away, you know, get outside the house and cause a big reaction, you know, because he was exiled. And so I've always struggled with this with me and her, because the pieces of me that I don't like, I'm quick to call stupid, you know, and like, I'm smart enough to know that I should be better.
Yeah.
And so, like, but when I'm having a bad day and for some reason my thoughts are causing this situationship to feel hard, you know, recently I've been trying to accept it and not try to fight it, not have a manager come in and try to manage it, you know. And so like yesterday I had a pretty good day, but yesterday I was pretty bummed. I don't know why, but I remember I was sitting there and I'm just like, all right, if you want to have a bad day today, go for it. I'm not going to stop you.
Like, you
know,
and you just do. And then, because if you really try to have a good day on just the feeling that you know, obviously, to yourself, that it's a bad day, it's just depressing and sad and very catastrophic if you're too much into covering up how you're really feeling about the day. And so I think, yeah, just it's a bad day. It's a bad fucking day.
And but letting it happen. And because what I'm prone to do is just take that little seed and then I'll just make it bigger for no reason. And it's all up here and it doesn't exist to me. It's the least real part, aspect of everything.
As long as it's controlled chaos, you're not actually doing any destruction to your life in that sense. Or maybe minimal destruction. Sometimes it involves substances, but as long as it's not destroying your life entirely. How do you, and I don't know if it applies to every substance, by the
way. How do you love it, though? Like, the pieces of yourself that are so difficult. Because, like, my therapist, and I believe her, the answer one day is being able to hold it and
right.
truly loving that, even though I hate it.
You know? I think just know, I know for me, I know that I have to accept it at some point. Part of the conditions of it, though, that I've had to accept too, is sometimes trying to jump ahead and accept it can, it's not that it inherently brings this, but sometimes without knowing, sometimes it brings disappointment to how much someone can still be holding on to it more than they actually want to hold on to it. Because I've gone there. And I had to learn that, no, this is going to have to take repeated tries of letting it go with every decision. Because I think that's just what it is. With every decision, am I still willing to let it go? Okay, I'm still willing to let go. Some people can let go of things and never have to repeat that to themselves. I know that I have to do it.
How about looking at it and saying you can stay as long as you want?
Sometimes it's that too. Like, I'm set up with this thought. I know I'm just thinking about it. So I'm going to sit here. I'm going to do something comfortable, like watch something. And I'm just going to deal with it. I'm going to fucking argue with myself. Fine. I'll look like a piece of shit, but let me do as much as possible to take care of myself while I do it.
100%.
Yeah.
It's good, though. It's strength.
Right. And I'm loving having that strength now. And I've gotten used to the fact that it's not always going to feel as perfect as it does right now at the moment or how it's felt for the past week. In fact, it hasn't been as consistent. I still get into thoughts that I've had for years now, and you know, for the most part, I think that's treating the thoughts and feelings as just passerbys. Bad songs, and then a good song comes. I think that's the best way I have felt to get to that point. Because it just is. Feelings and thoughts, they come and go. You know, I'll get disturbing thoughts and think, man, am I really that disturbing of a person? But the reality is I just get disturbing thoughts, and how I would think of myself ultimately and how I would be happy is the ultimate decider of what I should do. And that's never an ending answer. Never is. I don't think for anyone it is either. But I don't know. Sometimes it can feel like an ending, and it's like a Hallmark movie. it's all creamy and good. the cards and the shows, it's all good feelings all the time. And sometimes it's that. Quite frankly, nothing to complain there, right? But, you know.
Yeah.
Just depends. Depends on what's worth it.
What is worth it?
Whatever feels worth it from the journey before it. We all think of things that are like worth it at that point in time. I thought it was worth it to shoot my sister in the ass with an airsoft gun right next to the TV. And I was successful, but I didn't fully realize that I could have broken something and gotten my dad pissed. For sure. So
better than a magnet.
And dude, a magnet?
Yeah.
What do you mean?
You put a magnet on one of those old TVs?
The cathode what? TVs? Explain this more.
The cathode ray TVs or something. The old school big ass
ones. A magnet? What does it do?
It makes it fucks up the screen. It makes it turn to like a rainbow. It'll never work again.
Work on CRT TVs?
I don't think on the new ones anymore.
Oh damn.
Because the cathodes were like, it was like a tube. Of gas.
Yeah, those old TVs are nuts.
I remember when my friend had one, he fucked up when we were kids.
Jeez.
Alright.
But yeah, we all think something's worth it, and we realize what's worth it just from experience. And sometimes it's a shared primal feeling, and sometimes that's expressed, and it's expressed in so many different ways. It's all cinematic.
So, we make up, to some extent, reality.
Yeah.
But to some extent, we don't. Because as soon as we start talking about it, what are we doing?
Right.
So we might as well just live it, right?
I think pattern making makes us close to it, but... And, yeah, I think... We just feel it out. We're always feeling it out. Even if you use a measured system, you're just feeling it out. But thank God for science.
Yeah, and drugs.
yeah, most definitely. I think for everyone.
Yeah. I really appreciate you coming to sit with me today, bud.
Hey, man, I appreciate you inviting me. It's wonderful to be here and discuss these things.
It's a big move. I want to start doing this more and having other people on. I miss
hearing that.
Not just being in my own echo chamber. So, thank you for taking me up today.
No problem, man. My pleasure.
This won't.